Thank you so much, Christian. So we'll be joined by Kojo and Neda, and we move over here to the far left corner, and I hope you still feel somehow able to touch base with us, despite the distance and the hour. Breathing exercise time. I mean, I don't think we can make that very long, just because it was a lot of input today. But I would like to try to inject some of the remaining reserve battery energy into the attempt to fold as much, to go as little as possible into historical detail and fold as much as possible into the present. But I know, at least from speaking for myself, that we'll probably fail. just a very brief remark to start with. I mean, There's a reason, I think, other than just mere lack of time, why we did not manage to work through the issue of primitivism and its use by or in the context of Cold War, of the cultural Cold War entirely. And that reason seems to me at least to be threefold. It has to do with the vortex and the void Kojo spoke about. It has to do with the kind of resolution of what primitivism was before the war into a, at least, let's say, compromised universality, and how that universality was perpetuated by the post-war modernism and its the way in which it sort of mapped onto the Krishna-like occupation of the semiotic field as sort of, and that probably might have to do something with this, why it arrived frequently not so much at the mask anymore, but increasingly at the Zen void, at a kind of an empty spirituality, right? Like one that was as full and as empty as can be at the same time. What I mean with that is like when you look at the primitivist references made by the abstract expressionist painters, for instance, you would encounter statements such as, while the previous generation has just looked at the formal aspects, right, the geometric, etc., borrowing, just appropriation, constituting oneself in this kind of strange double gesture of reference and disavowal, we are actually interested in the spiritual dimension. That is something one finds in the writings of the abstract expressionists at various junctures. It somehow strangely feeds into what one could
loosely describe as this what I thought was really brilliant in Nida's brief exposition, what has happened to the production of meaning in the arts, particularly. In this double figure of like Eshu as the dividing force that then reconstitutes the possibility of agreeing on meaning by appearing and reconciling the friends, right, after he has made it impossible, therefore sort of exposing the twinness, which I think is what interestingly Richard Wright enables us particularly to look at the twinness of the bipolar confrontation, everything they have in common rather than everything that divides them. And on the other hand, that occupation of the semiotic square, if you will, in the Krishna metaphor, that contains meaning and no longer allows meaningful oppositions. In a brief and funny small conversation I had with Boris Groys in the course of preparing this exhibition, he was referencing a paper he had written on proposing that while the East is the message and the West is the medium, and this kind of primitivism that ends up in the empty signifier of the Zen circle, I think one can perhaps also see that sort of dreaming up of the medium condition that then finds a very articulate medium in a figure like Marshall McLuhan. Catholic as he may be, he voices this medium condition in an interesting way. Now, we have been, and then I'm done. We have been traveling in the course of preparing this exhibition to two major Cold War exhibitions, both taking place in Germany, one in Munich, one in Karlsruhe, and we tried to understand their narratives. I'm not going to go into detail. I'm just going to mention two sort of polemic conclusions that we were tempted to make. One was in Karlsruhe, and given the institution and its collection and its overall narrative, in a sort of way, one could say, suggested basically that the grand drama of the post-war period was in an almost messianic way redeemed by the advent of mass media and its and their democratization. No? So, I mean, in this show here, we are hinting to that narrative and its flaws, hopefully, or the loss of currency that this narrative has, by inserting Nam June Paik's Big Brother from the early 80s next to the Apple clip referencing Big Brother, where in both cases you have this, not positioned next to, but in the same space. In both cases you have sort of this instantiation of how the decisions, traumas and evils of the century are redeemed in this medium condition. That promises ultimate global democratization and allies very closely with the artist and the figure of the creative in general, right? On the other hand, the grand show at the Haus der Kunst, perhaps, and there's a lot to be said about it, but maybe we can just take from it this one thing, that the kind of paradigm of re-narrating modern art history by basically including what was formerly excluded from the canon follows, perhaps at least in parts of its intention, what one could call a paradigm of representational justice. What has been the wrongs that have been foundational to modernism are righted by simply including it in a, and there seems to be in this very process, at least to us, when we were thinking through the CCF history and its antinomies, one major problem with that paradigm, that somehow in the very amassment of works of art, somehow the conflict has gone missing. somehow that which the very living grounds which has made these works perform at such scissions that were so brilliantly pointed out by the play with what a mask could mean, and in a film like Usman Simbenz is just striking because it becomes animated exactly through that which cannot be said, right, through this endless silences in the film. And through that silence, the very overlapping boundaries and scissions that are at play become the elephant in the room. I'm already speaking far too long. I just wanted to see if you can react to that, and also invite you to participate very soon.
I mean, there's a sense that masks are, they're a media. Masks are a medium. But when you see masks presented, there's always some intermediation that's gone missing. They're media without a symbolic system. So you're just staring at them, and now they become riddles. Riddles of the mask, not riddles of the Sphinx. You know. That's one thing that always strikes me. And the other is the meta Warwick Fuller, you know, because that's an Ethiopianist civilizational work. And it's a work I like a lot, but I looked at it and I just thought of the notion of an exhausted modernism, you know. A kind of exhausted Ethiopianism with this frame of Egyptianism, an Egyptological Ethiopianism. That's all I can think of at the moment. I'm still putting those two together. So it's not actually even a response yet. It's just two elements that will become a response.
Yeah. I just spoke for quite a time and a bit ran out of voice, but I think it's interesting what you said about Meta Warwick Fuller's sculpture, and I would like maybe to add about the more contemporary from the 90s, this video from the 1990s from a French post-migration background. This is also very Egyptian in approach. You know, the whole group is formed itself during very, very close study of Sheikh Anta Diop's writings in the late 80s, and based a kind of pharaohism on their own. Created a kind of pharaonic identity for this. The members of the group, so they took on names like Akhenaton and many others, but at the same time, which I found so really interesting shift in the historical trajectory of the response to the museum and the exhibition of the African art and African sculpture is that this is not only an African or only a black response, but this is a very mixed group. This is a group of young migrants from Marseille of diverse ethnic backgrounds that consider themselves as discriminated minority against the background of the rise of the Front National in France. So this is a direct reaction to this French racism. And this is a multi-ethnic response that refers somehow, I mean, I don't know about if it's a direct reference to the film by Macaire and René, but it might be. So this is a kind of global, I don't know if I can call it a global, because Coach, you were talking about the global Cold War, but I liked as a notion, because that is also, from my perspective, from my research on, it's also very important to look at this. If you have this notion of the global Cold War, You even can go back, I think, in history to 1917. And so the Cold War starts at that time with the Russian Revolution, which is a Cold War between Russian anti-imperialism in the colonies and European Western colonial power structure. So it's before the Cold War proper, there's some other kind of Cold War going on. And Semben was trained in Moscow. He shot his first films with a Soviet camera that he brought back from the Gorky studio and so on. So there's this, I mean, that is very, of course, complex and complicated and too many.
I wonder still yet, I mean, because I think what it has become clear also in the juxtaposition of these two presentations is somehow how incomplete and difficult this task of re-narration still is. And that it might, that's why I was bringing up these two paradigms, and that they're both perhaps presenting a limit, you know, like the limit of, on the one hand, dealing with it through representational justice, undoing the wrongs, righting wrongs. On the other hand, dissolving it in this false universality, maybe it's too strong to say false, but into the tendency of a universality in which basically the primitivist project began to be channeled in the 50s at the same time of the emergence of communications theories, technologies, and cybernetics. So this was, you know, the Karlsruhe story, right? You overcome the borders through that sort of global vision, and we've heard that several times referenced today as well, this communication ideal. The IMSes are, of course, paradigmatic for that, and they're also for that reason in the exhibition with one of their films on that very topic. And on the other hand, we have that question of, you know, the institution, a museum dealing with that history, looking back and trying to, you know, insert the missing pieces. And in what way does that change the narrative profoundly, right? Is something where I think this, at the core of that problem, somehow I see, you know, there is a vacuum of the narrative, and it has to do with what I thought, at least, Kojo tried to address with the vortex and the void, that overshadows this ability to narrate the global Cold War from, you know, because there is no vantage point from which one could do that sort of in a museum way, positivistically, objectively, right?
Okay. In response to this kind of question of the retroactivity of, say, the post-war exhibition, and maybe also, I mean, in relation to, I think, Kojo's comment about the mask. So we have a work, a documentary in the show that was directed and edited by Frank Speed and Uli Bayer, and it's called New Images, and it was it came out in 1964, which was perhaps a year after Statues Also Die was made public. 10 years after it was made, but then it wasn't public for a while, right? And then it was in somehow.
The Statues, the film? You mean it was,
yeah.
It was censored, yeah. It was not on screen.
Right. So in a way, this comes right after its kind of public appearance, and it is very much in that sense dealing with the tension between the museumization of this kind of primitivism, in a way, versus its kind of everyday life, right? the exhibition, I mean, the film is in the exhibition. But also, I think there is a relationship, my mind's not at its best right now, but with the kind of legal understanding of, or legal kind of Greek term for person and the relationship to the word mask as well. And I think maybe Antonia will help correct me if I'm wrong, but Arendt talks about the necessity for the mask in a democratic society. So if you can basically keep the distance between, or manage that divide between your kind of personal persona and your public persona, then you are in a democratic context. And in that sense, not being able to have a mask would be somehow the totalitarian reality. So I think we're move. I mean, the mask in all those different kind of.
I guess, I mean, so we have Le Statue Mergo aussi, and you have Le Noir de. So in both cases, masks are, through montage, masks take on a kind of, they take on an inscrutable life. Yeah, they take on some kind of, they become entities which do things that are not immediately legible, but are nonetheless having effects. You know, that's the silence. That's why the silence becomes so loud. Things are happening, but they're not necessarily readable. But the montage is putting you in a place so that you can't not see that things are happening. Just because you can't see them doesn't mean they're not happening. So the montage puts you into this kind of subsurface processing that masks do, you know. And so to me that seems very strong, the emphasis to that the montage brings masks, the montage animates masks and mobilizes them in a certain way. And that and clearly animates spectatorship, and that's why in both cases you're at this you are the spectator, the scene of spectatorship in both cases. And I guess you know, those are mid-century moments, like quintessentially 50s and 60s moments. So I can understand why they function in the orbit of this exhibition and this conference, because they speak to those moments. I mean, you know, they work chronologically and they work in their aesthetic politics. But I didn't see either of these Cold War shows, unfortunately. So the in a way, you know, once when the context changes drastically, when the medial surround like expands massively, then changing everything in it, you know. So nothing in it has changed, but the context is enough to change everything, you know. And then when montage doesn't function in the same way anymore, you know, I guess that's because, you know, I always feel we're in a post-montage condition. I mean, we're in a kind of condition of navigation, so a world in which we click and move around. So we can look at montage and see it as this incredible system of mobilization while knowing that we touch our phones between 100 and 200 times a day. So that's partly what I'm also, when I say exhausted modernism, I don't mean that in a flip way. I mean, we don't have a contemporary animation system for those masks yet. We're looking at how they did it. And then we're looking at the anti-colonial, the kind of secret politics of an anti-colonial gesture. That's why they're so compelling, you know. But we don't have our navigation yet. I don't think so. I suspect a lot of us are working towards it, you know.
OK.
Can we turn on the light?
Thank you, everybody. It was. I have a feeling that, you know, now that we did this exhibition and this conference, we actually have to do it all over again, once again, right? With everything that we kind of encountered on the way here, and with kind of, you know, working through the challenges that we already went through, now with other tools that we acquired on the way here. I'm extremely inspired and moved by the vortex and the void idea, and I'm thinking about what Anselm was saying about our encounter with these two major exhibitions that were trying to put together the narrative of the post Second World War art in this particular historical moment. I'm bringing it back to something that I was only hinting yesterday. In the comparison with the way that Fred Moten uses the idea of the universal eye as both subjectivity and the optics, as he takes it from Denise Ferreira da Silva. For me, the striking thing about the idea of the void is exactly how it relates, or how it can relate in a Promethean and indeed prospective way to the idea of the mass that is belonging to exactly that affectable eye, of both eye as an optic and subjectivity. That means a reconsidering, as you put it, the kind of figuring out a new vocabulary for nihilism, as Richard Wright was trying to do. And I'm just thinking how in this void, it is like the, you know, when Borges in the essay on blindness, he's talking about the kind of the flawed understanding of sighted people about how people who don't have the sight perceive black. And he says, in fact, the only thing that you really miss when you're blind, you miss blackness. You always see shadows of gray and so on, or creamy and so on. Anyways, I'm just thinking through this idea of the void as a potentiality, as a flawed, if you want, under quotation marks, as affectable, providing us perhaps with the kind of a, you know, equally uneasy to navigate archipelago of certain. Certain potentials, I guess, in terms of particularly of understanding the mass. And here I come to something that I think is really brilliantly articulated in some of the newer work by Shai Landa, who is talking about fascism in a I think a very interesting way as a phenomenon. Something that we have been learned to think as
who is
a
that? Shy?
I'll tell you later.
Yeah.
The fascism as the mass movement. But Landa says, no, in fact, fascism is not a mass movement. It was a movement and the victory of the middle classes. Right? So how do we reconfigure also the figure of the mass, right? And how do we work not from the vortex that always puts everything and brings everything in the circulation the same way that the universal eye that wants to do canon narrative by inclusion, annotation, giving voice, endorsing, and so on, or this kind of redemption through media? How do we, in fact, try to endorse this void as a Promethean possibility to speak through the affectable as a new mass that has that kind of a potential of a new universal becoming, I guess. And it is, as I said, unfortunately, I cannot structure it as a question, but it did come through your talk on Richard Wright and also on what Ansel was saying in terms of our understanding of these endeavors and attempts to narrate the canon again. So I guess it was, as I announced, unfortunately, more of a monologue than a question. I couldn't constrain myself. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
We have a question.
Hello. A few words and then a question, perhaps. Thanks for all the presentations. And I thought it was, it's actually opening a lot of discussions, which are really, I would be very curious and happy to see unfolding in the future, in a sense. I think that this question of the void, which I think is one of like the central thing, but I wouldn't use the word void in that sense, or when you said spiritual, the spiritual void, where if I would say void, then I think it's too close to some sort of religious concept in a sense. But I understand the question of what causes the spiritual void for millions and millions of people, which comes out as a kind of cultural operation, from, as you have identified, from Europe, and we have seen all these kind of travels with all the questions that are posed in regarding how to read images and what kind of Cold War do we have. And the problems that are really, I mean, very, very important to ask today, namely, for example, when you say what happened when there is no emotional home, and as you have depicted, you went so far, Kocho, to say that is has, like, Nazism has been an answer to this, in a sense. So I think that we can see that, on the other hand, we had stories that were actually telling us about an affective history that was emphasizing to be completely euphoric, namely in Yugoslavia, which is a very different position in geography. And I think this is interesting because finally I thought that this gives us a lot of possibilities to do to understand through this modern art shows and perspectives geography in a different way, in a sense, right? So it's a kind of making borders through art history or through the reading of art, and or depicting new territorial limits in that sense. And I think one of the, for me, very important political levels in there is what I could read in this question about what is the pathos of distance, really? How does the, as you say, what is it? This would be my question to you. What is the pathos of distance? How does it act in this globalization of free agents, of undisciplined impulses, of unintended outcomes from entanglements, etc.? So is that, which you, I think, kind of posed in a very positive way, and I think this is important to follow, but I would say there is, of course, the question: how do we read these images, or how do we do read these events, without really focusing to the problems of representation itself, in a sense, meaning representation perhaps not being any longer the field of analysis that we have to reflect, a representation that is overdriven or accessed constantly through things like the parts of distances that are assuming a certain way of reading images from a specific perspective. So we cannot even say multi-perspectivism, or we have to say multi-perspectivism, but I think we have to kind of understand this kind of foldings and unfoldings and foldings again within globalization, in a sense. So perhaps you can just say, I don't know if this makes any sense what I'm saying, but maybe you can just tell me something about this pathos of distance that I wasn't, of course, I saw it in the way you depicted the work, the reading of the work, but I'm interested to understand it and how you would put it as a point outside or from art, modern art, outside to something else, I don't know.
No, thank you. It's you raise many compelling questions. You know, I'm still working these things out. When you return to this kind of mid-century vocabulary, you know, Richard Wright with his vocabulary that's very much immersed in the kind of, you know, mid-century existential and phenomenological language. That's what it is. And he's trying to get it to take account of racial capitalism. And then he's trying to read it in terms of what we would call the afterlife of slavery. But he has this other language, the psychology of national oppression. So, you know, he has these very elaborate concepts, but they are also quite, they're awkward ones for us. And the pathos of distance isn't, that's a Nietzschean term, which he, you know, these are terms that he constantly tries to rework. He wants to work with them and then change them and then have them operate differently. So then when you do an essay like this and you return to all of these languages, which in a way are, they don't circulate so much, you know. This is very much trying to work out, you know, what are the valences in Wright's language. For me, the point is, it's not so much the you're right, the notion of the void is not as important as the notion of these processes that are happening on a planetary scale. What was important was the way he scaled up from the city of Chicago, Bigger Thomas, and by the time of White Man Listen in 57, he's talking about, you know, several continents. It's that's what's interesting to me, the way he's talking about processes and the way those processes put pressure on the vocabularies of communism that want to speak for them. And what's compelling for me is the way the figure of blackness is not contained by communism, but which implodes communism. So that conceptual reversal, which I see a lot in the work of Denise Ferrer de Silva or Frank B. Wilson III or Sadir Hartman, there are these, you take a term which always has an awkward conceptual fit, but instead of like trying to cut it to shape, you reverse it and you use this term to put pressure on some, you know, some kind of normative and valued vocabulary. And these are the elements that I find useful in Wright. So I'm not so wedded to the particular vocabularies. And so you're right, pathos of distance, it's like, okay, fine. But it's certain operations that he's doing with the language that he has, because he's writing in, you know, 1940, 57. So that's what I find interesting. But it took this conference and this setting. You know, Richard Wright is a figure you grow up with forever. You know, he's always around. It's like, yes, Richard Wright. And in a way, he's stuck in a kind of eternal Oedipal battle with Baldwin. You know, and in a way, you'd say clearly Baldwin is a more compelling figure for this time. But it took this conference and the kind of reframing that allowed me to say, well, what if? Like, what is at work across Wright's, across these different moments in Wright's trajectory, you know? And so I think that speaks to what you're talking about, the exhibition as a border-making machine, the exhibition as a kind of geography of portals and a geography of attention and a geography of duration and a geography of a geography of experimentation with modes of attention and spectatorship, and under those conditions, you make these kinds of speculative readings, which are normally foreclosed, you know, because in a way, right is locked by literary history, by, you know, canonical histories of African-American literature. He's like locked, done, nothing more to be said. But there is more. It's because we live in a time when there are, when the appeals of neo-reaction are very, very virulent. You know, and so then you see Wright as this fearless figure who somehow continually went where the bad news was. He just went to the processes of, you know, these processes of desocialization. You know, he continually went to these places where there's no culture in any recognizable way. There's nothing that talks back to you with a capital A or a capital C. No, there were just processes going on, you know.
Three questions? I guess then we call it also a day, no?
Yeah, thanks so much. I have like maybe two things that I wanted to float. The one is that when Wright responds to the Englishman, the first thing that he seems to say, if I remember correctly, is that would have been a very costly endeavor if 6 million Jews had to pay. And what I thought is interesting about that is that that seems to grow, or like at least it plays on the Marxist idea of like analyzing this through the language of political economy. And this is one of the breakage points of Marxism in the 20th century, right? Like, can we understand the Holocaust within the language of political economy? Frankfurt School says no. Some others say yes, right? So I wanted to ask you what happens in the aftermath to this, you know, like with this question of like how far does political economy go and what does it become? That would be like my question. And the other thing that I thought was interesting is that when you showed the scene from the Resnais film, and we have the description of the mask, and we have like the description of the black woman looking at the mask, what we see is her face, right? So what we see is her face, black woman face, being described with the language of white men, imagining black woman's feelings towards African mask, right? So it seems to me that there's a conflation going on, which speaks to like the Fanon mask thing also. But what I thought is interesting here is that there seems to be an interesting gender play going on, all of a sudden, where a real figure in a film, which happens to be a woman, becomes the stand-in for the African mask, and becomes the figure of unity, for example, which also has a lot to do with like, you know, religious imaginations of motherhood and like these kinds of things. So I thought I'd give that in and ask for a response to that. So like political economy and the gender of the mask. That's the questions. Thank you.
I think it's very very hard to speculate about the. I think it's even more hard to speculate. Maybe not even more, but as hard to speculate or as difficult to speculate about the thoughts of the filmmakers as it is about the thoughts of the visitor in the museum, in particular, because I was not able, I mean, would be really very much interested in figuring out much more about the very concrete form of collaboration between Présence Africaine as the commissioner of this film and the two artists who executed it. Of course, at that time they were both young, not so well-known artists, filmmakers, but they were, of course, very much in their own tradition of, for instance, surrealism and very French traditions. Yeah. so they had their own, of course, their own reflection about the history of surrealism, alienation, appropriation, primitivism, and so on. But they were, on the other hand, very clear in the film that they are commissioned to do it for this organization and the magazine. I mean, this is not so much about the gender question, what I said so far. I don't know about the gender question. I don't know what, I don't have a clear answer to that.
I mean, the right scene in this club in Accra, you know, I've actually tried to find out where it is, but I'm still searching for it. I mean, clearly, you know, it's a fable of right's encounter with this repellent racist figure who actually, you know, seems to stage some kind of calculation, some kind of, you know, is effectively arguing for, you know, some kind of economic calculation of the Holocaust. And Wright effectively, the thing about Wright is, I meant it when I said he was unembarrassable. So instead of being, I mean, he's clearly outraged by it. He says it three times that you know, Hitler's actions are criminal, which means the guy who is making those claims is also a criminal for making them. But he doesn't put it in quite that way, and he relishes these moments where people say, like, embarrassing racist things. I mean, Wright just relishes them, because these are the moments at which the, you know, this term he uses, he has this complex kind of, you know, he over-psychologizes everything, because that's the 50s, and the psychological is a kind of condensation of a lot of his readings, whether he's reading, you know, Heidegger or Erich Fromm. It all comes into this kind of psychological language of a kind of hydraulic language of expressions and drives. But effectively, these moments, I don't think it's so much about political economy. I think it's more about the embarrassment of listening to some, you know, confronting somebody whose racism, who actually tries to actually work out the kind of to economically offset the Holocaust. And instead of being outraged and screaming, Wright just takes this guy as basically a case, a symptom of a certain kind of English colonial continuity, you know. So that's what makes it fascinating, because Wright basically gives him a reading syllabus. He's like, look, I wrote The Outsider. You've never read it, but I wrote it, and let me tell you what that does, because in that book, I've anticipated everything you're saying now. Like, my characters do what you're doing now before you did it, you know. So you, this repellent British racist, you're already a character in my book, you know. I think about people like you and the kind of things you do. I know what you're made of. So you can't, you know, I'm not going to rise to your criminal-minded fantasies. So, and I think that's what it is. And these questions, these moments that Wright relishes, these moments of kind of racist, the kind of, you know, what you do when you're confronted by somebody who enjoys racist fantasy, what you do when you're confronted by somebody who relishes a kind of racial reasoning, and who just digs into it, like how you deal with it. Like, that's what Wright is very good at doing, because the Deep South is like this nightmarish school in that. And then he exited at 19, he's gone, you know. So he worked out methods. There's a really good book, I quoted this line, the death-bound subject, by a literary historian, Abdul Yan Muhammad. And it's before AP, it's before Afropessimism, but it's when you read it now, it reads like a kind of, it prefigures a lot of things that Wilson and Hartman are saying, but he wrote it much earlier. And he says, you know, the thing about writers growing up in the Deep South, that means growing up at the point of death, you know. And so the everything he writes, the poetry, the fiction, you know, there's a reason why Ta-Nehisi Coates' breakthrough book is called Between the World and Me, which is a Richard Wright poem. There's a reason why he named his book after Richard Wright poem, because that poem, which is about a man witnessing a lynching, who then effectively swaps with the person being lynched, and then like imaginatively sees himself being lynched, like prognostically in the future. There's a reason why Ta-Nehisi Coates went to that poem. It speaks to the horror, you know. So Wright is good for these moments, you know. And you know, if I have my way, we'll find a way to republish this this volume, you know, because it's 1,008 pages and it should be around so we can actually look at it closer. Because he was struggling with really quite early things, and he wasn't like the political scientists who were all referring to each other, and he wasn't like the African American intellectuals of a decade later. He was by himself, working it out, making terrible mistakes, dressing like an old colonial with his pith helmet. I mean, he risked a lot, you know. So it's a thinking that risks. It's not a safe thinking, you know, because he's an autodidact, you know. I think that has a lot to do with it as well. So I'll be happy to share this, you know, if you're interested. I'll be happy to share the relevant pages with you. Okay.
I guess I don't meet strong opposition if I'm closing the session. Thanks a lot to everyone on stage and off stage.